Is the idea of the cosmic controversy or the great controversy unique to Adventism? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm Alden Thompson from the Walla Walla University School of Theology, your host and study guide author, as we begin a new series on the preparation for the end time. My conversation partners are Matilda Fry, Associate Professor of Biblical Studies in the School of Theology at Walla Walla University, and Brant Berglund, Assistant Professor of Biblical Studies in the School of Theology at Walla Walla. So let's tackle that first question. Is the idea of the cosmic controversy unique to Adventism?
Well, gauging by popular media, even in movies, I think this idea of a cosmic controversy is not anything specific to Adventism, but certainly within the context of Christianity, there are others who have had things to say about a great battle between good and evil. I don't think we are the first, are we?
I don't think so.
I don't think so either. There, I think along the history of humanity has always been the idea of the good and versus the good versus the bad, the good versus the evil, who are in conflict with each other.
I think in terms of Christian literature, you have John Milton and more recently C.S. Lewis, who have built their faith edifices around the idea of a cosmic conflict. One of my favorite quotes relating to the conflict comes in Lewis's description of the role of prayer in the conflict. And I'll just repeat that here because I think it is very significant. It's from his essay, Efficacy of Prayer in the World's Last Night and Other Essays. Prayer is not a machine. It is not magic. It is not advice offered to God. Our act when we pray must not any more than all of our other acts be separated from the continuous act of God himself, in which alone all finite causes operate. It would be even worse to think of those who get what they pray for as a sort of court favorites, people who have influence with the throne. The refused prayer of Christ in Gethsemane is answer enough to that. And I dare not leave out the hard saying which I once heard from an experienced Christian. I have seen many striking answers to prayer, and more than one that I thought miraculous. But they usually come at the beginning, before conversion, or soon after it. As the Christian life proceeds, they tend to be rarer. The refusals, too, are not only more frequent, they become more unmistakable, more emphatic. Does God then forsake just those who serve him best? Well, he who served him best of all said, near his tortured death, "Why hast thou forsaken me?" When God becomes man, that man of all others is least comforted by God at his greatest need. There is a mystery here which, even if I had the power, I might not have the courage to explore. Meanwhile, little people like you and me, if our prayers were sometimes granted, beyond all hope and probability, had better not draw hasty conclusions to our own advantage. If we were stronger, we might be less tenderly treated. If we were braver, we might be sent with far less help to defend far more desperate posts in the great battle. So he highlights that great battle there and the potential role that each of us plays. Now, a question. What biblical passages are central to the understanding of the conflict?
It seems the conflict is bookended in the Bible, in the biblical record, at least the way it's been put together with Genesis and Revelation, are the main places I think most people go, yes?
I would think so. I think in terms of this lesson here, that's probably where our focus would be. Are there other passages that are essential to it?
I think the book of Job is one very important aspect of that, but also then in the interpretation of scripture, passages like in the apocalyptic literature of Isaiah and Ezekiel would be part of this aspect of a cosmic conflict. Isaiah 14, Ezekiel 28.
Interestingly enough, those are not applied to Satan until well into the Christian era, which is really kind of intriguing, which taps into a special interest of mine, that Satan really, I was startled when I first realized this, that Satan is almost never mentioned in the Old Testament as a supernatural entity opposed to God. In fact, only three times, the whole Old Testament. So That was, as we look at that particular fact, I want to, we'll come back to that several times this quarter, but I'd like to go now to Revelation 12, which is a special interest of yours. At least Revelation is supposed to be a special interest of yours, Brant.
It is, yeah.
And I think of the war in heaven there, which is a surprising passage. And I don't know if you two were as surprised as I was first time I discovered that, because I always thought of the war in heaven as something going way back in primeval times. But here in Revelation, it climaxes at the cross.
Yeah, Revelation 12 certainly is focused on the work of Christ in bringing a death blow to the ancient serpent, the dragon. And what's fascinating is that those who overcome the dragon as well do so by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. It's clear that the cross did something that was not expected, perhaps, or it's not something that Adventists see for sure. We look at a final consummation of this great battle and expect that Revelation portrays that, but something dramatic happened in the battle at the cross.
Well, I think it's definitely important to note that the writer of that book writes his visions after the cross, and in light from that is coming from the cross. So Jesus Christ is definitely highlighted in this book.
And I think we'll talk more about that this quarter when we talk about Revelation as a revelation of Jesus Christ, where he's central rather than beasts or even the great controversy. It's Jesus that's central.
I'd like to, before we move on and get too far away from Revelation 12, I'd like to read the key passages there in Revelation 12, because it, for me, it was really startling when I first really heard it. Beginning with verse 7, "War broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon. The dragon and his angels fought back. But they were defeated, and there was no longer any place for them in heaven. The great dragon was thrown down, that ancient serpent who is called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. He was thrown down to the earth, and his angels were thrown down with him. Then I heard a loud voice in heaven proclaiming, 'Now have come the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Messiah. For the accuser of our comrades has been thrown down, who accuses them day and night before our God. But they have conquered him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, for they did not cling to life even in the face of death. Rejoice then, you heavens, and those who dwell in them. But woe to earth and sea, for the devil has come down to you with great wrath, because he knows that his time is short.'" Now, this is not only the first place in the Bible where the serpent is identified as Satan. It also indicates that there was a war throughout the Old Testament times. And the shift in cosmology, I think, is really quite interesting, because if you take this cosmology seriously, Satan had access to the heavenly courts. You see this in Job,
yes,
where he comes from wandering to and fro on the earth, and there's this dialogue between God and Job. But after the cross, that is no longer possible. He is cast down to the earth, and he is left here. Do you see any particular things of interesting and intriguing that on that point that you'd like to comment on?
Actually, when I think about the temptations of Jesus, Jesus was asked to worship Satan, the accuser, and Satan said, "I have all the kingdoms of the world that I can offer you," as if they were his to do so. But now, when I look at verse 8 here, it says there's no longer a place found for him in heaven. If Satan had access to the throne room of heaven at one point, he lost that place. What I find interesting is it says there's no longer a place found for them, that is Satan and his angels, in heaven, but Jesus uses the exact same words in the Johannine literature in the Gospel of John to say, "I go to prepare a place for you, the disciples." He removes Satan and his angels, and now he prepares that place for us.
Now, I'd like to circle back to the beginning of the lesson here. We talk about preparation for the end time as the overall theme. There are a couple of intriguing statements from the official study guide that run like this. "Not only do we not know when the end," climaxing with the second coming of Jesus, "will come, we don't need to know." Now, that caught my attention because Adventists have typically said, we've got to know where we are. But the principal contributor here says, we don't need to know. What do you think of that?
I think it's consistent with Matthew 24 and 25. And I think we'll cover Matthew 24 and 25 later this quarter. But the point doesn't seem to be so much knowing the exact time. It's rather being ready now.
It's also very much a part of the Gospel of John, I believe, because there you do not have even the question of the disciples, when is it going to happen? Jesus does not respond to that at all, but rather to what is going on between Jesus leaving and Jesus coming back. And in that space in between, there is the Spirit.
Uh-huh.
The Father, the Spirit, and the Son
present.
Yeah.
Good. Now, when we look at the lesson itself, the great controversy, I am intrigued by the question of how we relate to the forces of evil in our everyday life. How much aware are you of Satan as you go about your daily life?
I certainly don't see it the same way perhaps the Gospels portray Jesus casting out demons. But if I look at influence, I think one of the points we'll talk about as well is secularism and the push there. That seems to be quite an insidious sort of creep on our culture.
Yeah.
And I think I can see it there. And that certainly has its ties, its tangles, its web that I can get caught in.
Uh-huh.
I think it's definitely a constant and a present in our daily lives. But on the other side, I believe the Bible, from the beginning to the end, makes a point in not making Satan as the equal counterpart to God. God is God, and that is why, especially in the Christian understanding of God, we still hold to the monotheistic God, the God who is one in himself, one in his being and unit in character. And Satan, no matter how much power he seems to have in the human part of the world, God is still the power and the authority, and Satan plays the minor role.
Mm-hmm. That's really intriguing because, well, in my life, I don't give a thought to Satan typically. He's very important to my theology, but in terms of everyday practice, it's not really all that much. Next week, we are going to be turning to the theme of Daniel in the end time, and we will explore that thought. Our conversation partners will again be Matilda and Brant, and we look forward to that. My thanks to Jared Miller, our program engineer, and to all of you for listening in. For the Good Word, I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.